The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street by Rod Serling. Act 1. Fade in on a shot of the night sky. The various nebulae and planets stand out in sharp, sparkling relief. As the camera begins a slow pan across the heavens, we hear the narrator off screen.
There is a fifth dimension beyond that which is known to man. It is a dimension as vast as space and as timeless as infinity. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition, and it lies between the pit of man's fears and the summit of his knowledge. This is the dimension of imagination. It is an area which we call the Twilight Zone.
The camera pans down past the horizon, stopping on a sign which reads Maple Street. Then it moves on to the street below. It's daytime. We see a quiet, tree-lined street, typical of small-town America. People sit and swing on gliders on their front porches, chatting across from house to house. Steve Brand polishes his car, while his neighbor, Don Martin, leans against the fender watching him. A good humor man on a bicycle stops to sell some ice cream to a couple of kids. Two women gossip on a front lawn. Another man waters his lawn.
Maple Street, USA, late summer. A tree-lined little world of front porch gliders, hopscotch, the laughter of children, and the bell of an ice cream vendor.
The camera moves back to the good humor man and the two boys who are standing alongside him, buying ice cream.
At the sound of the roar and the flash of light, it will be precisely 6:43 p.m., on Maple Street.
One of the boys, Tommy, looks up to listen to a tremendous screeching roar from overhead. A flash of light plays on the boys' faces. It moves down the street, past lawns and porches and rooftops, and disappears. People leave their porches or stop what they're doing to stare up at the sky. Steve Brand stops polishing his car and stands transfixed, staring upward. He looks at Don Martin, his neighbor from across the street.
What was that? A meteor?
That's what it looked like. I didn't hear any crash, though. Did you?
Nope. I didn't hear anything except a roar.
Mrs. Brand, from her porch.
Steve, what was that?
Guess it was a meteor, honey. Came awful close, didn't it?
Too close for my money. Much too close.
People stand on their porches, watching and talking in low tones.
Maple Street, 6:44 p.m. on a late September evening. Maple Street in the last calm and reflective moments before the monsters came.
The camera pans across the porches again. A man is screwing in a light bulb on a front porch. He gets down off the stool and flicks the switch, only to find that nothing happens. Another man is working on an electric power mower. He plugs in the plug and flicks the switch of the power mower off and on, but nothing happens. Through the window of a front porch, we see a woman at a telephone pushing her finger back and forth on the dial hook. Her voice is indistinct and distant, but intelligible and repetitive.
Operator, operator, something's wrong on the phone. Operator.
Mrs. Brand comes out on the porch and calls to Steve.
Steve, the power's off. I had the soup on the stove and the stove just stopped working.
Same thing over here. I can't get anybody on the phone either. The phone seems to be dead.
The camera looks down on the street. Small, mildly disturbed voices creep up from below.
Electricity's off.
Phone won't work.
Can't get a thing on the radio.
My power mower won't move. Won't work at all.
Radio's gone dead.
Pete Van Horn, a tall, thin man, is standing in front of his house.
I'll cut through the backyard, see if the power's still on Floral Street. I'll be right back.
He walks past the side of his house and disappears into the backyard. We see the hammer on his hip as he walks. The camera pans down slowly until we're looking at 10 or 11 people standing around the street and overflowing to the curb and sidewalk. In the background is Steve Brand's car.
Doesn't make sense. Why should the power go off all of a sudden and the phone line.
Maybe some sort of an electrical storm or something.
That don't seem likely. Sky's just as blue as anything. Not a cloud, no lightning, no thunder, no nothing. How could it be a storm?
I can't get a thing on the radio. Not even the portable.
The people again murmur softly in wonderment and question.
Well, why don't you go downtown and check with the police? Though they'll probably think we're crazy or something. A little power failure and right away we get all flustered and everything.
It isn't just the power failure, Charlie. If it was, we'd still be able to get a broadcast on the portable.
There's a murmur of reaction to this. Steve looks from face to face and then over to his car.
I'll run downtown. We'll get this all straightened out.
Steve walks over to the car, gets in it, and turns the key. Through the open car door, we see the crowd watching him from the other side. Steve starts the engine. It turns over sluggishly and then just stops dead. He tries it again, and this time he can't even get it to turn over. Then, very slowly and reflectively, he turns the key back to off and slowly gets out of the car. Everyone stares at Steve. He stands for a moment by the car, then walks toward the group.
I don't understand it. It was working fine before...
Out of gas?
I just had it filled up.
What's it mean?
It's just as if everything had stopped.
Then he turns toward Steve.
We'd better walk downtown.
Another murmur of assent at this.
The two of us can go, Charlie.
He turns to look back at the car.
It couldn't be the meteor. A meteor couldn't do this.
He and Charlie exchange a look. Then they start to walk away from the group. We see Tommy, a serious-faced 14-year-old in spectacles, standing a few feet away from the group. He's halfway between them and the two men, who start to walk down the sidewalk.
Mr. Brand, you better not.
Why not?
They don't want you to.
Steve and Charlie exchange a grin, and Steve looks back toward the boy.
Who doesn't want us to?
Tommy, jerking his head in the general direction of the distant horizon.
Them.
Them?
Who are them?
Whoever was in that thing that came by overhead.
Steve knits his brows for a moment, cocking his head questioningly. His voice is intense.
What?
Whoever was in the thing that came over. I don't think they want us to leave here.
Steve leaves Charlie and walks over to the boy. He kneels down in front of him. He forces his voice to remain gentle. He reaches out and holds the boy.
What do you mean? What are you talking about?
They don't want us to leave. That's why they shut everything off.
What makes you say that? Whatever gave you that idea?
Now, isn't that the craziest thing you ever heard?
It's always that way in every story I've ever read about a ship landing from outer space.
From outer space yet? Sally, you better get that boy of yours up to bed. He's been reading too many comic books or seeing too many movies or something.
Tommy, come over here and stop that kind of talk.
Go ahead, Tommy. We'll be right back. And you'll see, that wasn't any ship or anything like it. That was just a meteor or something. Likely as not.
He turns to the group, now trying to weight his words with an optimism he obviously doesn't feel, but is desperately trying to instill in himself, as well as the others.
No doubt it did have something to do with all this power failure and the rest of it. Meteors can do some crazy things, like sunspots.
Sure. That's the kind of thing. Like sunspots. They raise Cain with radio reception all over the world. And this thing, being so close, why, there's no telling the sort of stuff it can do. Go ahead, Charlie. You and Steve go into town and see if that isn't what's causing it all.
Steve and Charlie walk away from the group again down the sidewalk. The people watch silently. Tommy stares at them, biting his lips, and finally calls out again.
Mr. Brand!
The two men stop again. Tommy takes a step toward them.
Mr. Brand, please don't leave here.
Steve and Charlie stop once again and turn toward the boy. There's a murmur in the crowd, a murmur of irritation and concern, as if the boy were bringing up fears that shouldn't be brought up. Words that carried with them a strange kind of validity that came without logic, but nonetheless registered and had meaning and effect. Tommy is partly frightened and partly defiant.
You might not even be able to get to town. It was that way in the story. Nobody could leave. Nobody except...
Except who?
Except the people they'd sent down ahead of them. They looked just like humans. And it wasn't until the ship landed that...
The boy suddenly stops again, conscious of the parents staring at him and of the sudden hush of the crowd.
Tommy, please, son. Honey, don't talk that way.
That kid shouldn't talk that way. And we shouldn't stand here listening to him. Why, this is the craziest thing I ever heard of. The kid tells us a comic book plot, and here we stand listening.
Steve walks toward the camera and stops by the boy.
Go ahead, Tommy. What kind of story was this? What about the people that they sent out ahead?
That was the way they prepared things for the landing. They sent four people, a mother and a father, and two kids who looked just like humans, but they weren't.
There's another silence as Steve looks toward the crowd and then toward Tommy. He wears a tight grin.
Well, I guess what we'd better do then is to run a check on the neighborhood and see which ones of us are really human.
There's laughter at this, but it's a laughter that comes from a desperate attempt to lighten the atmosphere. Charlie laughs nervously, slightly forced. The people look at one another in the middle of their laughter.
Hey, there must be something better to do than stand around making bum jokes about it. I wonder if Floral Street's got the same deal we got. Where's Pete Van Horn, anyway? Didn't he get back yet?
Suddenly, there's the sound of a car's engine starting to turn over. We look across the street toward the driveway of Les Goodman's house. He's at the wheel trying to start the car.
Can you get it started, Les?
Les Goodman gets out of the car, shaking his head.
No dice.
He walks toward the group. He stops suddenly as, behind him, inexplicably and with a noise that inserts itself into the silence, the car engine starts up all by itself. Goodman whirls around to stare toward it. The car idles roughly, smoke coming from the exhaust, the frame shaking gently. Goodman's eyes go wide, and he runs over to his car. The people stare toward the car.
He got the car started somehow. He got his car started!
The camera pans along the faces of the people as they stare, somehow caught up by this revelation, and somehow, illogically, wildly frightened.
How come his car just up and started like that?
All by itself. He wasn't anywhere near it. It started all by itself.
Don approaches the group. He stops a few feet away to look toward Goodman's car, and then back toward the group.
And he never did come out to look at that thing that flew overhead. He wasn't even interested.
He turns to the faces in the group, his face taut and serious.
Why? Why didn't he come out with the rest of us to look?
He always was an oddball. Him and his whole family. Real oddball.
What do you say we ask him?
The group suddenly starts toward the house. In this brief fraction of a moment, they take the first step toward a metamorphosis from a group into a mob. They begin to head purposefully across the street toward the house at the end. Steve stands in front of them. For a moment, their fear almost turns their walk into a wild stampede. But Steve's voice, loud, incisive, and commanding, makes them stop.
Wait a minute! Wait a minute! Let's not be a mob!
The people stop as a group, seem to pause for a moment, and then much more quietly and slowly start to walk across the street. Goodman stands there alone, facing the people.
I just don't understand it. I tried to start it, and it wouldn't start. You saw me? All of you saw me?
And now, just as suddenly as the engine started, it stops. There's a long silence that is gradually intruded upon by the frightened murmuring of the people.
I don't understand, I swear! I don't understand what's happening.
Maybe you better tell us. Nothing's working on this street. Nothing. No lights. No power, no radio, nothing except one car. Yours.
The people pick this up. Now their murmuring becomes a loud chant, filling the air with accusations and demands for action. Two of the men pass Don and head toward Goodman, who backs away, backing into his car. He is now at bay.
Wait a minute now. You keep your distance, all of you. So I've got a car that starts by itself. Well, that's a freak thing, I admit it. But does that make me some kind of criminal or something? I don't know why the car works. It just does.
This stops the crowd momentarily. And now Goodman, still backing away, goes toward his front porch. He goes up the steps and then stops to stand facing the mob. Steve comes through the crowd.
We're all on a monster kick, Les. Seems that the general impression holds that maybe one family isn't what we think they are. Monsters from outer space or something. Different than us. Fifth columnists from the vast beyond. You know anybody that might fit that description around here on Maple Street?
What is this? A gag or something? This a practical joke or something?
The spotlight on his porch suddenly goes out. There's a murmur from the group.
Now I suppose that's supposed to incriminate me. The light goes on and off. Well, that really does it, doesn't it?
Looking around the faces of the people.
I just don't understand this.
Wetting his lips, looking from face to face.
Look, you all know me. We've lived here 5 years, right in this house. We're no different than any of the rest of you. We're no different at all. Really, this whole thing is just weird.
Well, if that's the case, Les Goodman, explain why...
She stops suddenly, clamping her mouth shut.
Explain what?
Look, let's forget this nonsense.
Go ahead. Let her talk. Well, what about it? Explain what?
Well, sometimes I go to bed late at night. A couple of times, I'd come out on the porch and I'd see Mr. Goodman here in the wee hours of the morning, standing out in front of his house, looking up at the sky. That's right, looking up at the sky as if he were waiting for something. As if he were looking for something.
There's a murmur of reaction from the crowd again. As Goodman starts toward them, they back away, frightened.
You know, really, this is for laughs. You know what I'm guilty of? I'm guilty of insomnia. Now, what's the penalty for insomnia? Did you hear what I said? I said it was insomnia. I said it was insomnia! You fooled, you scared, frightened rabbits, you. You're sick people, do you know that? You're sick people, all of you! And you don't even know what you're starting, because let me tell you, this thing you're starting, that should frighten you. As God is my witness, you're letting something begin here that's a nightmare.
Fade to black. Act 2. Fade in on the entry hall of the Goodman house at night. On the side table rests an unlit candle. Mrs. Goodman walks into the scene, a glass of milk in hand. She sets the milk down on the table, lights the candle with a match from a box on the table, picks up the glass of milk, and starts out of the scene. Cut to an outside shot. Mrs. Goodman comes through her porch door, glass of milk in hand. The entry hall, with the table and lit candle, can be seen behind her. The camera slowly pans down the sidewalk, taking in little knots of people who stand around talking in low voices. At the end of each conversation, they look toward Les Goodman's house. From the various houses, we can see candlelight but no electricity. An all-pervading quiet blankets the area, disturbed only by the almost whispered voices of the people as they stand around. The camera pans over to one group where Charlie stands. He stares across at Goodman's house. Two men stand across the street from it, in almost sentry-like poses. We return to the group.
It just doesn't seem right, though, keeping watch on them. Why, he was right when he said he was one of our neighbors. Well, I've known Ethel Goodman ever since they moved in. We've been good friends.
That don't prove a thing. Any guy who'd spend his time looking up at the sky early in the morning, well, there's something wrong with that kind of a person. There's something that ain't legitimate. Maybe, under normal circumstances, we could let it go by. But these aren't normal circumstances. Why, look at this street. Nothing but candles. Why, it's like going back into the Dark Ages or something.
Steve walks down the steps of his porch. He walks down the street over to Les Goodman's house and stops at the foot of the steps. Goodman stands behind the screen door, his wife behind him, very frightened.
Just stay right where you are, Steve. We don't want any trouble. But this time, if anybody sets foot on my porch, That's what they're going to get. Trouble.
Look, Les,
I've already explained to you people. I don't sleep very well at night sometimes. I get up, and I take a walk, and I look up at the sky. I look at the stars.
That's exactly what he does. Why, this whole thing, it's some kind of madness or something.
That's exactly what it is. Some kind of madness.
You'd best watch who you're seeing with, Steve. Until we get all this straightened out, you ain't exactly above suspicion yourself.
Steve, whirling around toward him.
Or you, Charlie. Or any of us, it seems. From age 8 on up.
What I'd like to know is, what are we gonna do? Just stand around here all night?
There's nothing else we can do.
He turns back, looking toward Steve and Goodman again.
One of them will tip their hand. They got to.
There's something you can do, Charlie. You could go home and keep your mouth shut. You could quit strutting around like a self-appointed hanging judge and just climb into bed and forget it.
You sound real anxious to have that happen, Steve. I think we better keep our eye on you, too.
Don, as if he were taking the bit in his teeth, takes a hesitant step to the front.
I think everything might as well come out now.
Turning toward Steve.
Your wife's done plenty of talking, Steve, about how odd you are.
Go ahead. Tell us what she said.
Steve walks toward them from across the street.
Go ahead. What's my wife said? Let's get it all out. Let's pick out every idiosyncrasy of every single man, woman, and child on the street. And then we might as well set up some kind of a kangaroo court. How about a firing squad at dawn, Charlie? So we can get rid of all the suspects. Narrow them down. Make it easier for you.
There's no need getting so upset, Steve. It's just that, well, Myra's talked about how there's been plenty of nights you spent hours down in your basement working on some kind of radio or something. Well, none of us have ever seen that radio.
Go ahead, Steve. What kind of radio set you working on? I never seen it. Neither has anyone else. Who you talk to on that radio set? And who talks to you?
I'm surprised at you, Charlie. How come you're so dense all of a sudden? Who do I talk to? I talk to monsters from outer space. I talk to three-headed green men who fly over here in what look like meteors.
Steve's wife steps down from their porch, bites her lip, and calls out.
Steve, please. It's just a ham radio set, that's all. I bought him a book on it myself. It's just a ham radio set. A lot of people have them. I can show it to you. It's right down in the basement.
Show them nothing. If they want to look inside our house, let them get a search warrant.
Look, buddy, you can't afford to be...
Charlie, don't tell me what I can afford. And stop telling me who's dangerous and who isn't, and who's safe and who's a menace. And you're with him, too. All of you. You're standing here all set to crucify. All set to find a scapegoat. All desperate to point some kind of a finger at a neighbor. Well, now look, friends. The only thing that's going to happen is that we'll eat each other up alive.
He stops abruptly as Charlie suddenly grabs his arm.
That's not the only thing that can happen to us.
Cut to a long shot looking down the street. A figure has suddenly materialized in the gloom. And in the silence, we can hear the clickety-clack of slow, measured footsteps on concrete as the figure walks slowly toward them. One of the women lets out a stifled cry. The young mother grabs her boy, as do a couple of others.
It's the monster! It's the monster!
Another woman lets out a wail, and the people fall back in a group, staring toward the darkness and the approaching figure. As the people stand in the shadows watching, Don Martin joins them, carrying a shotgun. He holds it up.
We may need this!
A shotgun?
He pulls it out of Don's hand.
Good Lord! Will anybody think a thought around here? Will you people wise up? What good would a shotgun do against a...
Now Charlie pulls the gun from Steve's hand.
No more talk, Steve! You're gonna talk us into a grave! You'd let whatever's out there walk right over us, wouldn't you? Well, some of us won't.
He swings the gun around to point it toward the sidewalk. The dark figure continues to walk toward them. The group stands there, fearful, apprehensive. Mothers clutch children. Men stand in front of wives. Charlie slowly raises the gun. As the figure gets closer and closer, he suddenly pulls the trigger. The sound of it explodes in the stillness. The figure suddenly lets out a small cry, stumbles forward onto his knees, and then falls forward on his face. Don, Charlie, and Steve race over to him. Steve is there first and turns the man over. Now the crowd gathers around them.
It's Pete Van Horn.
Pete Van Horn? He was just going to go over to the next block to see if the power was on.
You killed him, Charlie! You shot him dead!
Charlie, looking around at the circle of faces, his eyes frightened, his face contorted.
But I didn't know who he was. I certainly didn't know who he was. He comes walking out of the darkness. How am I supposed to know who he was? Steve, you know why I shot. How was I supposed to know he wasn't a monster or something? We're all scared of the same thing. I was just trying to protect my home, that's all. Look, all of you, that's all I was trying to do. I didn't know it was somebody we knew. I didn't know.
There's a sudden hush and then an intake of breath. We see the living room window of Charlie's house. The window is not lit, but suddenly the house lights come on behind it.
Charlie, the lights just went on in your house. Why did the lights just go on?
What about it, Charlie? How come you're the only one with lights now?
That's what I'd like to know.
There's a pause as they all stare toward Charlie.
You were so quick to kill, Charlie, and you were so quick to tell us who we had to be careful of. Well, maybe you had to kill. Maybe Peter there was trying to tell us something. Maybe he'd found out something and came back to tell us who there was amongst us we should watch out for.
No, it's nothing of the sort. I don't know why the lights are on. I swear I don't. Somebody's pulling a gag or something.
He bumps against Steve, who grabs him and whirls him around.
A gag? A gag? Charlie, there's a dead man on the sidewalk and you killed him. Does this thing look like a gag to you?
Charlie breaks away and screams as he runs toward his house.
No, please!
A man breaks away from the crowd to chase Charlie. The man tackles him and lands on top of him. The other people start to run toward them. Charlie is up on his feet. He breaks away from the other man's grasp and lands a couple of desperate punches that push the man aside. Then he forces his way, fighting through the crowd, to once again break free. He jumps up on his front porch. A rock thrown from the group smashes a window alongside him, the broken glass flying past him. A couple of pieces cut him. He stands there perspiring, rumpled, blood running down from a cut on his cheek. His wife breaks away from the group to throw herself into his arms. He buries his face against her. We can see the crowd converging on the porch now.
It must have been him!
He's the one!
We gotta get Charlie!
Another rock lands on the porch. Now Charlie pushes his wife behind him, facing the group.
Look, I swear to you, it isn't me. But I do know who it is. I swear to you, I do know who it is. I know who the monster is here. I know who it is that doesn't belong. I swear to you, I know.
What are you waiting for?
Come on, Charlie, come on.
Who is it, Charlie? Tell us.
All right, Charlie, let's hear it.
Charlie's eyes dart around wildly.
It's...
Go ahead, Charlie. Tell us.
It's the kid. It's Tommy. He's the one.
There's a gasp from the crowd as we cut to a shot of the mother holding her boy. The boy at first doesn't understand. Then, realizing the eyes are all on him, he buries his face against his mother, Sally.
That's crazy. That's crazy. He's a little boy.
But he knew. He was the only one who knew. He told us all about it. Well, how did he know? How could he have known?
How could he know?
Who told him?
Make the kid answer.
What about Goodman's car?
It was Charlie who killed old man Van Horn.
But it was the kid here who knew what was going to happen all the time. He was the one who knew.
Are you all gone crazy? Stop!
A fist crashes at Steve's face, staggering him back out of view. Several close camera shots suggest the coming of violence. A hand fires a rifle. A fist clenches. A hand grabs the hammer from Van Horn's body.
Charlie has to be the one. Where's my rifle?
Les Goodman's the one. His car started. Let's wreck it.
What about Steve's radio? He's the one that called them.
Smash the radio! Get me a hammer! Get me something!
Stop! Stop!
Where's that kid? Let's get him!
Get Steve! Get Charlie! They're working together!
The crowd starts to converge around the mother, who grabs her son and starts to run with him. The crowd starts to follow, at first walking fast and then running after him. Suddenly, Charlie's lights go off, and the lights in another house go on. They stay on for a moment. Then, from across the street, other lights go on, and then off again.
It isn't the kid! It's Bob Weaver's house!
It isn't Bob Weaver's house! It's Don Martin's place!
I tell you, it's the kid!
It's Charlie! He's the one!
The people shout, accuse, scream. The camera tilts back and forth. We see panic-stricken faces in close-up and tilting shots of houses as the lights go on and off. Slowly, in the middle of this nightmarish morass of sight and sound, the camera starts to pull away until once again we've reached the opening shot, looking at the Maple Street sign from high above. The camera continues to move away until we dissolve to a shot of the metal side of a spacecraft, which sits shrouded in darkness. An open door throws out a beam of light from the illuminated interior. Two figures silhouetted against the bright lights appear. We get only a vague feeling of form, but nothing more explicit than that.
Understand the procedure now? Just stop a few of their machines and radios and telephones and lawnmowers. Throw them into darkness for a few hours, and then you just sit back and watch the pattern.
And this pattern is always the same?
With few variations. They pick the most dangerous enemy they can find, and it's themselves. And all we need to do is sit back and watch.
Then I take it this place, this Maple Street, is not unique.
By no means. Their world is full of Maple Streets. And we'll go from one to the other and let them destroy themselves. One to the other. One to the other. One to the other.
Now the camera pans up for a shot of the starry sky.
The tools of conquest do not necessarily come with bombs and explosions and fallout. There are weapons that are simply thoughts, attitudes, prejudices, to be found only in the minds of men. For the record, prejudices can kill, and suspicion can destroy, and a thoughtless, frightened search for a scapegoat has a fallout all of its own for the children. The children yet unborn. And the pity of it is that these things cannot be confined to the Twilight Zone.